The other day, my wife and I had date afternoon. The babysitter was coming. We were going to Tacoma to get some lunch. And, well, what else could we do other than get lunch in the middle of the afternoon? Well, it's near an art house. So we decided we're going to go over to this theater, right? However, we have 5 children, and getting out is a big deal. And our knowledge of new releases playing in theaters is very limited. Mostly we know about what Disney Plus is pitching to us at the moment. Is it a soulful story of a girl who turns into a panda, or the soulful story of a black man's soul escaping heaven? I mean, we don't really know anyway, because the kids prefer video games. Being therefore completely ignorant of what films were even playing in theaters these days, I checked the web and I asked my wife, do you want to see the movie about the English teacher who's estranged from his daughter, or the one about the queen whose corset gets tighter and tighter? That's both a joke and true, because those were the 2 options at the Grand Cinema on that particular Saturday. Jessica says, given those choices, I'd watch the one about the English teacher. And so we did. At some point in the film, pizza's ordered, important plot point there, and then there's a knock on the door to deliver the pizza, and they say that it's Gambino's. And I think that's funny. Huh, look at that. The box even has a little fedora on it and the word Gambino's. I lean over to my wife and I'm like, that looks just like Gambino's in Moscow. But I guess there's not too many different ways to do a pizza logo other than like the word Gambino's and a fedora, maybe? I don't know. Then I notice that the nurse in the film is wearing a fleece with a Gritman Medical Center logo on it. Somebody was found dead in the river near Lewiston? Wait, is that a book people bag hanging next to the door? It's too bad theaters are so dark, because no one was able to see the stupid look of realization come over my face when I realized this movie, The Whale, was set in Moscow, Idaho. The screenplay was written by Samuel D. Hunter, who indeed grew up in Moscow. Today we're going to talk about The Whale because it received multiple Oscar nominations this week. The odds of a Moscow-based movie being made are honestly pretty good, more than one. But they're all indie films, which none of us have ever seen. This one you will hear about while you watch the Oscars. We're on the Compass of Power podcast, so we're going to talk about the place of this movie. That involves politics because, as we say here on the Compass of Power, place is politics. We will talk about the role of religion in the film, the role of academia, of art and sexuality, and how every one of those themes is reflective of the culture of the Palouse in general and of Idaho and Moscow in particular. And we'll talk about what is not Moscow about the film. And look, I did not intend for this podcast to become the All About Moscow, Idaho cast. I promise I will move on. Unless this helps me monetize somehow, because my goal in life is to transcend human knowledge and monetize my assets. What are the odds that 2022's most revolting quadruple homicide and one of its most dazzling motion picture films would be set in the small North Idaho farm town where I lived, where I went to college, where I worked? It's just, the opening is there and I gotta throw the punch. On the murder side, I would like to say that I am feeling like I called it. Go back and listen to the episode entitled Moscow, Idaho and a Cultural Blindness to Evil. I recorded that episode before Brian Kohlberger was arrested and charged with murdering 4 University of Idaho students in November. But in that podcast, I realized that I and a lot of other people who knew Moscow were ignoring a simple explanation for the gruesome killing of innocent people. Maybe it was done because it was evil. Maybe, I said, this was a murder planned out with victims added later, and the work possibly of a serial killer. And I'm going to stop right here and say that the accused are innocent until proven guilty. However, nothing about my sudden realization has in any way been undermined by the revelations in the case, I would say. I would say the opposite. And Kohlberger turned out to be a student at Washington State University in nearby Pullman. And you cannot talk about Moscow, Idaho and the University of Idaho with talking about WSU and Pullman, Washington. See that episode. That's not our topic today, though. Our topic is, While the news media is showing the shocked and horrified by brutal homicides side of Moscow, a Hollywood film is showing the fat man emotionally locked inside his own guilt, literally locks himself inside small Moscow apartment side of Moscow. The Whale received Oscar nominations for Best Actor and Best Actress in a Supporting Role. Both of these nominations for Brendan, George of the Jungle, Frasier, and Hung Chow are totally deserved. And I'm probably going to spoil the ever-leaving bejeebers out of this plot because I want to talk about the movie, and I don't know if you've seen it or not, but I'm just going to go there. It's also, I'm not going to really talk about the plot because that's not my point. The point is to talk about the place. So this is just a warning that I don't know what I'm going to say here. Be on guard. Question, am I qualified to be a movie critic? I would like to refer back to my Moscow creds because Moscow, Idaho, bizarrely has a strong theater tradition, of which I took part. I mean, when I was a kid, every summer we'd go to Moscow and we'd watch the repertory theater. They had a professional theater over the summers. And, you know, that's a big deal because most acting, in case you didn't know, when it comes to the stage, is for free. But they did, in fact, have, they pay people to come and act through the summer. And we typically would take in a Rodgers and Hammerstein musical and, like, some Shakespeare. And I think they typically did, like, a murder mystery. I remember seeing some of those. It was a big deal. I mean, my mother loved it. We all went there and we watched it. And we'd go to the pantry at the University Inn afterwards, if you know what I'm talking about, Moscow people. That theater, the Hartung Theater, is still there. It was built in 1973. Which takes us to the glory days of when we had Patrick the Starfish as a student. That's right. Bill Fagerbakke. He voices Patrick Star in SpongeBob SquarePants. He also played Dauber in Coach, if you want to go way back. And more recently was in How I Met Your Mother. And this Bill was raised in Rupert, Idaho, and he played football for the University of Idaho Vandals, where he did his first acting bit, as I understand it, in Godspell. That was back, he graduated in like 1981. Okay, so there you go. We have a legitimate known person from the University of Idaho. That's our claim to fame up until now. Now we have the Whale. And while I attended the University of Idaho, I saw every single play produced there during that time. It was like one of those things you start doing, you go to a few, and then you're like, I saw every one of them they did this year. I'm going to see everyone next year. And you just keep going. And the theater program, at least when I was there, was robust enough that there were many theater kids, and I thought of them as, you know, they're like the marching band kids or whatever, the accounting kids. I don't know. There's plenty of them, and you knew of them, and it was a large college within the university, shall we say. I don't know how many, I feel like I saw multiple productions of that Sam Shepard play, Fool for Love. Oh, what a terrible play too. I mean, it's probably good, but oh, miserable. And there's some common themes in those student written plays and vignettes and things that I saw and that I assume are still being done at the University of Idaho. Those themes make up the backbone of the Whale. Now, what's interesting is none of this is true about Pullman or Washington State University. In fact, while I was a reporter covering Washington State University, fresh out of college, they went through this closure program for the theater, theater degree and whatever, the whole nine yards. And I left before that was resolved, but it looks like it is gone now. I just was perusing WSU's website, and it looks like they still have some student-run theater, maybe an improv group, but nothing, you know, there's no degree. There's not a big program. You're not like selling tickets so far as I can tell. Could be wrong. I do remember going to WSU and watching Equus. Oh, the chinkle chinkle, the chinkle chinkle. But let's just recap here. Moscow, University of Idaho, 11,000 students, has a robust, long-running theater program with some legit Hollywood connections. Pullman, Washington State University, over in Washington, 8 miles away, 21,000 students, they've got an improv group. But they do have a criminal justice program in which the accused killer Koberger studied. Yes, he was a WSU student. The Cougars may wipe the floor with the Vandals when it comes to football or literally any other sport you could name. But in the public relations battle of 2022, victory to Idaho, I say. Okay, on to the whale. The first person you encounter in this story, outside of a bunch of online students looking bored, is the protagonist, Charlie. And he is fat. We better just talk about that right now, because what people remember about this movie is that it was the fat guy movie. Charlie is what the doctors would call morbidly obese, which turns out to be a pretty darn accurate term in a narrative sense. He's corpulent, sweaty. Especially early in the film, we are circling this enormous man way too closely. We are getting too intimate with his bulbous folds. We want to back up. We are in horror. In fact, director Darren Aronofsky makes such good use of like our compulsive revulsion that some activists are angry about it. They're like, why do we treat large people like monsters? Well, as this film very nimbly shows, it's because we find them disturbing. That may not be right, but the writer, director, actors are all putting that emotional lever to maximum work right off the bat in the show. You find yourself leaning back in your seat to try and create some distance, and you really hope this guy doesn't stand up, because that seems like it will break some of his bones. Wait, is that Brendan Fraser in a fat suit? Man, give that guy an Oscar. Oh man, best use of fat suit since Weird Al. And I don't mean Daniel Radcliffe's six-pack, you know what I'm saying, for that other movie. Jeez, Brendan Fraser, wow. Now that we have the Oscar nod out of the way, we meet character number two, and we get into some very, very Moscow-ness and Idaho-ness. Because I don't know if you know this, but Moscow, Idaho is not known for morbidly obese people. It has its culture, as we've discussed before, is the Palouse is a farming area founded mostly by like Germans and Scandinavians. It's pretty laissez-faire, but it's Idaho itself is rich with recreational opportunities. And the vibe in Moscow, Idaho is very Portland, Oregon, in that everyone is a rock climber, a whitewater rafter, or at least dresses like they are. But the character that shows up number two in this film is not of that type. He is the clean-cut white boy on a mission character. He's a missionary. This is Thomas, played in the film by Ty Simpkins. And if you are at all familiar with Mormons, you would think that Ty is one of them. He looks and he acts like the familiar missionaries, the friendly, helpful, full of zeal for Jesus Christ kids that come to your door and ask if they can tell you about the Book of Mormon and also do any favors for you. And here's the political geography for you vis-a-vis missionaries in Idaho. Many, many Mormons call Idaho home. About 1 in 5 adults in Idaho is a Mormon. But this is a regional thing. Remember, Idaho's shaped like a big letter L. That panhandle to the north, where Moscow is located, was deliberately created as a gerrymandering technique to protect the Pacific Coast's control over what is now Washington State. They split the Democratic vote between what is now Eastern Washington and North Idaho. And by doing that, they ensured that the population base of Washington stayed on the coast. That's why Moscow is in the state of Idaho, even though there's only one road connecting North Idaho to South Idaho, and Boise is 300 miles and one time zone away. It's also why the University of Idaho is in Moscow. It was a sort of pork barrel payment to the people of North Idaho in exchange for the fact that they lost control of their political future for all time. North Idaho is religiously eclectic. It actually has one of the largest populations of people who subscribe to no religion in particular, the nuns. It has a strong presence of Native American Catholics, who got their start with Jesuit missionaries to the area prior to the arrival of white settlers. Southern Idaho, as the old joke goes, is northern Utah. It is somewhat true. It's southern Idaho is a long, long way from Moscow, and there's a very strong Mormon presence. In many southern Idaho cities, Mormons are culturally dominant. Again, you literally are just north of Utah, which is, was founded by Mormons. That's not the case in Moscow. Moscow lacks a single dominant religion, and that makes them vulnerable to takeover, like literally vulnerable. Back to the movie. One of the things I think this film does well is, if not deliberately, they let people go astray, take advantage of our expectations. And our first impression of this young Christian kid character, Thomas, is that he must be clean cut. You know, he has that, right or wrong, I feel that Mormonism in popular culture has like a very fresh and clean and optimistic attitude. And whether, you know, sometimes they're held up for almost as a joke, which probably isn't fair, but I don't think they're held up as particularly evil. And as events unfold in the film, you start to feel like, well, this is like the, you know, maybe he's just the zealous Christian kid. Maybe he, you know, maybe he's a little rebellious. Don't know. We're starting to feel some vibes about his parents. And he's contrasted strongly with that estranged daughter we heard about in the synopsis, Ellie. Ellie is clearly mad at her dad, Charlie, for not behaving. And she doesn't behave in a very religious manner. Let me put it that way. She's like supposed, she is the foil to the clean cut kid, is the estranged daughter. And now we've got some Moscow vibes going in full strength. Because let me tell you, a lot of those student-written plays and vignettes that I had to watch, they featured these sort of Mormonish kids from southern Idaho grappling with their conservative homes. A common theme, which we again find in The Whale, is sexuality. You know, you have grappling with a gay or lesbian identity in the face of disapproval or confusion. Our movie features a gay college instructor, Charlie, who left his wife and daughter for a former student. Now he's in poor health, and he's visited by this young Christian missionary kid, and he's looking to save Charlie. But is he trying to save Charlie from his bad eating habits or from his gayness? We're not quite sure. Simultaneously, Charlie's trying to connect with his a-religious daughter who hates his guts for leaving her. This setup is frankly just like all the other student drama you may find at the University of Idaho. I mean, at one point while watching The Whale, I leaned over to my wife and I was like, I feel like I'm back in college watching a play, but I'm sober. And guess what? The Whale was a play. It was adapted for the film by the playwright, Samuel Hunter. The director makes majestic use of the tight confines of Charlie's apartment. And the gorging scenes, they feel like you're watching a whale feeding frenzy caught on camera by National Geographic and with this deep string music underneath. I was a little terrified myself. But in its weaker moments, this movie feels like it's a one-set stage play being recorded by the guy who couldn't land a speaking role. It just starts to feel like it's a play. And if this was all The Whale was, questioning the role of parents and religion and self-determination, being who you are, plus a lot of time spent talking about English assignments, it would basically be the same as every other damn play ever put on in Moscow, Idaho. But this is not Napoleon Dynamite, and it's not about growing up in southern Idaho. It's written by a guy who grew up in Moscow. So the question every character asks of Thomas, the missionary, is, are you from New Life? Isn't that a cult? Big reveal here, folks. New Life in the film is a stand-in for the real-world New St. Andrews College. New St. Andrews is not Mormonism. It got its start in the 90s in Moscow. It is a religious college associated with the Presbyterians. And these guys are hardcore. They are biblical fundamentalists who just hold as a core tenet of their faith that the Bible is literally true. And it's not on the Bible to bend to modern times. It's on us to understand how what's literally true in the Bible applies today. And the founder of this is Doug Wilson, as I like to call him, the anti-Wilson. I'm sure that, you know, we're all part of the same clan, but these two Wilsons see things differently. And actually, Doug Wilson holds an interesting place in my academic history, and that he's a good professor. I had him as a professor, but I think he's the only professor that ever insulted me on the basis of religion. I don't think that was intentional, but let me just say that Doug Wilson and Adam Wilson had different views about Northern Ireland and the Good Friday Accords back in the day. But that's what you might expect, because the Presbyterian Church is Scottish in its origin. We've talked often here about the fighting Scotch-Irish, and that is a dominant political and cultural force in many parts of the United States. It's certainly present in North Idaho. And what's remarkable about New St. Andrews is that it does not mess around. It does not mince words. They come straight at you with what they're about and what they want, and then you get to deal with it. They're not going, they do not apologize for their existence. And I'm going to play you a little clip from a video by New St. Andrews that I think illustrates this nicely.
Half of us worked on construction, and half held the spears, shields, bows, and coats of mail. And those who carried burdens were trained to labor on the work with one hand and hold a weapon to defend it with the other. And all had a sword strapped to their sides and a tool in their hands. In the ruins we live, even while we rebuild them. In the ruins we marry and make love and raise children who raise the walls. In the ruins we craft wine and raise sanctuaries and barns. In the ruins we build and we film and we write and we read and we sing and we laugh and play rugby with pumpkins.
Okay, I think you get the idea. I mean, they're kind of going from like a biblical sort of like, we are in the ruins of the church, but we will rebuild the walls, to like, also we're going to play rugby with pumpkins. But they don't make any excuses for where they come from. And although not mentioned in a couple of videos that I went through, including one from Doug Wilson that's well done, talking about why he founded New St. Andrews, he doesn't mention why he chose Moscow, Idaho. But let me tell you, just Google Doug Wilson, New St. Andrews, Moscow, Idaho, look for some news stories. And he has gone on the record many times saying that he picked Moscow as a target. The intent was to find a liberal college town where you could win, where you could take over the culture and bring it back to righteousness, essentially, right? Like, this is a little liberal town, was lost their way, and we're going to go there and we're going to bring them around. And as you can imagine, you know, Idaho is not a especially liberal place. It's not known for that. But Moscow, Idaho, being home to farms and a college, it had a reputation for being more lenient than most places. And the arrival of New St. Andrews, which started buying property in downtown Moscow and putting on classes, you know, there was instant flare-ups. I remember there's a battle over breastfeeding, right? Because eventually you have folks in the town who are saying they don't. Oh, there was a topless car wash. I remember this. There was a topless car wash, and some people did not like that. And then there's like, how do we get rid of topless car washes? I hate those. And then they couldn't figure out how to write the ordinance without banning breastfeeding. And then, you know, there was there's tinge of morality in that one, which was led to the just straight up battle over slavery, because there was a pamphlet available in the library that was all about, what does the Bible say about slavery? And surprise, the Bible is kind of like not challenging slavery. I don't want to like hold myself as a scholar here, but it's definitely not like, and let me tell you why slavery is wrong. On the other hand, as we all know, many religious leaders in the United States, from the Quakers to Martin Luther King Jr., looked at the Bible and found justifications for battling not only slavery, but prejudice in all its forms. So that was a big dust up. Who wrote this? How dare you say that the Bible might sanction it? And the tone is important here, because true to their nature, this branch of Presbyterianism, they feel like they should just tell you what their plan is. Our plan is to come here and take over your town. Our plan is to believe in the Bible all the way down. And we're going to make things as close as we can to the way we want them. And when you come at folks straight like that on the palouse, it's jarring. And at least when I was there, it was this constant issue of like, well, we like diversity and we want to be tolerant of everyone's lifestyle. But then if you hold that position, how are we supposed to oppose these people who are definitely doing things we don't like? And while that was a political and social dispute, the real estate area got interesting. And this is where we can kind of tie this back into the quadruple homicide, is that New St. Andrews started in buildings downtown Moscow, or at least that's where they really set their base. And then there was immediate conflict between that and the bar scene in Moscow, Idaho. And Moscow, Idaho has a huge bar scene, restaurant scene, for its size compared to Pullman, where, again, there are almost twice as many students and half as many bars. And we talked about this in another episode, but that dates back to the days when the drinking age was legally lower in Idaho than it was in Washington. So Moscow became the destination for students of both universities to come to eat, to drink, and have a good time. That's how you end up with a situation when you were able. I'm sure folks are a little bit more security conscious now, but for a long time, Friday, Saturday night, 4 a.m. in Moscow, Idaho, everyone has just wandered home and gone to bed. And that's when those murders happened. And yes, it was a WSU student coming across the border into Moscow, because that is far more likely to happen than Moscow students coming across the border to Pullman. Because why would they do that other than go to a house party? Not to say that there's like some sort of blame there. I'm just explaining all of that is part of this constant ebb and flow. But New St. Andrews is an interesting addition to that flow, because they're literally, as they expand and they're very successful, and as Doug Wilson said in the video I watched, it started with his daughter in the first class, and they just enrolled his grandchild. So they've actually been through a whole generation now of students, and they're successful with their worldview and their education strategy. And that means they take up more physical space, aka have bought buildings, and it was a very limited downtown area in Moscow. So actually, there's pressure now where the dollar well is an endangered species because it's losing habitat in Moscow. Can I put it that way? Like, you can't, where are you going to get a Colorado bulldog when you've only got four spots left to hold bars? Literally, the buildings are being bought up, and that turned into a battle in Moscow. And to get back to the whale and the movie we're talking about, the struggling clean cut kid, the missionary who shows up, who thinks God brought him there to save Charlie, he's not going to have a turn of heart. He's not going to turn out to just want what's best for everybody. Or maybe he does, but not by like bending his values. He turns out to be a little tougher than you think. And a brilliant part about this movie is that I think everyone takes a few turns. Credit to Sam Hunter for writing that way, in that you take these kind of archetypal rebellious girl, missionary kid, repentant dad characters, and they are all going to turn on you a few times. The Liz character, as played by Hong Chau, is a great example of, like, I don't know, it felt very Moscow to me, because her backstory is that she was adopted by leaders in the New Life, the quote-unquote New Life Church, but had a falling out with the whole darn organization over the way her brother was treated, her brother being Charlie's partner. And I just want to say that Hong Chau deserves, like, huge props for her performance, because it was so efficient. The way she was able to convey things with gestures and pauses, very impressive. But if we're talking about the cultural geography of Moscow, I thought she was a great addition, because she is not, she is totally acculturated there, and not in a good way. She's mad at individual people. She's mad at the way a family treated someone she knew. And I think that is familiar, you know, like when you have those sort of tight knit religious networks, you're going to find people on the outs with them. Doesn't matter what the religion is, doesn't matter what they believe, but you find people who are alienated, who either are going to have to conform more than they can to fit in, or they're looking for some kind of accommodation for reality. In this case, that her brother was gay and they just could not deal, and she felt like that led to his demise. Again, this constellation becomes more and more familiar as a Moscow, Idaho phenomenon, where you're dealing with the professor character who is trying to get his students to write something true, right? And there's this classic, you know, just like, give me art kind of thing, which, you know, I understand, but still very collegiate. But you also have this durable question of religiosity and God, and no one in this film shies away from talking about God, which I think is very unusual from a West Coast perspective. Where I am at now on the West Coast, religion is kind of a verboten topic, because you don't want to offend anyone. And actually, it's funny, because you don't want to assume something about their religion, I think, is the way we rationalize it. But I think in practicality, the actual offensive thing is to discuss religion. So these are all aspects of the culture that's just very, very specific to Moscow that show up in The Whale. And I don't think that in that film, they ever say the word Moscow. Not once. I heard them say Lewiston once. Did not hear Moscow. So let's talk about why this is based in Moscow. Clearly, Samuel Hunter, the playwright turned screenwriter, was building off of his knowledge of Moscow, and the little things like having Gambinos in there or book people are nods to it. But he's not a University of Idaho student. He was born and raised in Moscow, born in 1981, the same year that Bill graduated, Bill Patrick Starr. And then he went on, I think, to Juilliard and the University of Idaho, Iowa, which, by the way, you can never go to the University of Idaho without people asking you about Iowa or move to Idaho or say you're from Idaho. For some reason, Iowa is more famous. New York University. Point is that while these are reflections of, I think, it's interesting because you think about it, these are themes that developed in Moscow over time, but they are not the University of Idaho experience. And I don't know why he exactly wrote about it, but if you go through his produced plays, and I have not read any of these, did not know this guy was alive until recently, but they have a strong geographical streak, and I encourage everyone to go out there and figure out what the heck he's talking about, because he has things like A Bright New Boise, one called Norway, one called Pocatello, Southern Idaho, one called Clarkston, one called Lewiston. Those are twin cities, and I've lived in both. And there's another one called Lewiston-Clarkston. You know, like, I don't know, are these being sold as exotic locales in New York? So, like, let me tell you about a place called the Lewis-Clark Valley. Probably not. I mean, what does New York give a crap about it? All right, let's bring it down to brass tacks. Where's this going? Well, one, good on you, Hunter, for making a career as a playwright doing geographically based plays about northern Idaho, eastern Washington. Also southern Idaho. Great work. Didn't know that was a possible career path, but you did good work. Good on you, Brendan Fraser. I felt really bad for you the whole time. But then sometimes not, because you're toying with my emotions like a cat plays with a string. But mostly, I guess I want to do this podcast because there are lots of people who watch this show and thought about the themes and did not care where it was set, did not pick up on where it was set. They were interested in the individuals in their lives. And if there's one thing I want this podcast to hammer into people is that your individual life is inevitably and deeply shaped by where you live. And where you live is not just some random product of geography, but a soup of history and society and culture to which you must conform. So The Whale has a lot of Moscow in it. And every other play, movie, song written anywhere by anybody has some bit of place in it, consciously or not. All right, that's it. That's it from me. You know, I have a website. It's called compassofpower.com. You can go there and check stuff out. It'd be really awesome if somebody would leave me a review on Apple Podcasts, because, like, you cannot find this show on Apple Podcasts due to its lack of reviews. And so far, I have refused to specifically go to people and be like, you need to give me a review so this will show up. I'm not above it, though. Don't think I'm above it. I'll do anything I need to. See a aforementioned dream to transcend reality. All right. See you guys.